Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, usairishradio.com, worldwide. I'm delighted to welcome a friend of both Anya and myself, and he is Tarla McConnell. But you're very welcome there, friend.
Thank you, Tarla.
And a little bit about yourself. And, you know, we know that you're a writer of great note, an author, a producer.
On exhibitions.
Yeah.
History exhibitions are my specialty.
I just want to ask you, though, about in your own career. Now, you're from Donegal. Where in Donegal are you from?
I'm from the wonderful peninsula of Inishowen.
Inishowen, my God.
Inishowen, right above Derry.
Yes.
In a former time, Derry would have been our capital city.
Yeah.
It certainly was our port city, where many left, Donegals left through Derry. And years later, others came through Derry. But Inishowen, Funcrana, Tardonna, Moville, beautiful spots. It's the,
I know,
it's the unclaimed part of Ireland.
It is. It's And of course, it's a huge and major, you know, tourist attraction as well. You grew up in Inishowen, and then what was your first entry into the career that you have perfected, and I don't, not just I say that, but many, many others as well. What morning did you get up in Inishowen and say, this is what I want to do?
I was raised in the main street of Buncrana. My family were retailers. My grandparents had a hotel. So I grew up right in the middle of a thriving Irish town that was a very popular tourist destination. This was before the problems in Northern Ireland stopped tourism to our part of the world. So I grew up in a really terrific seaside resort with everything that goes with that. Fun, bars, music, plays, everything. So because my family was involved in all of it, I just knew that I wanted to be at the center of the universe, which I thought I was in Valtana. But then I learned as I got older that I went to Dublin, went to London, and came to New York kind of as a second thought. New York was not in my primary thought, even though I had relatives in Queens. But I London and Dublin were more my thing, because of the arts and because my interest was plays, and I applied and I got into the Abbey Theatre as a young fellow. I got involved with music, I got involved with playwriting. And before I knew it, I met a girl from New York, and we came to New York, and it was Lorraine, still part of my life, and we came to New York, and lo and behold, the minute I arrived in New York, I said, I'm home. The minute I got here, Adrian, and I had to talk Lorraine into it, because she wanted to go back to Ireland, even though she was a Brooklyn girl. But anyway, we made our lives, got married, got divorced, had children, had grandchildren, had a full life here in New York, and it's been, for me, an adventure that started in Buncrana and continues in New York.
You know, a more than interesting, chain of events there that landed you again in New York. Okay, as a writer and as, you know, somebody who already had a lot of experience, obviously, in art and the arts and, how did you get involved in exhibitions, and where did your fondness for museums and history, which you know, spans both sides of the Atlantic. Where did that come from, or when did you realize that that's what you wanted to do?
It was always there. First of all, I'm Irish, so the story is what mattered. Remember, the biggest leverage in history is story. And it was stories that mattered. My father's a storyteller. I loved the history of Donegal. I loved the history of Ireland. And then when I came to New York, I was so taken by the Irish-American experience. And it took me about 4 or 5 years to realize that it was a different experience than my experience of Ireland. But I can tell you, I can almost tell you the day that it changed for me, where I was able to pull my two worlds together, was the day that I met Neil O'Dowd and Patricia Hardy at Irish American Magazine.
Yeah.
That's more than 30 years ago. And I, at that point, I was very much working in corporate communications in New York. You know, great job, overlooking Central Park. I was doing all kinds of interesting work. But I really wanted to be part of the world that Neil and Patricia were creating, because I just realized that this Irish-American world was something terrific to be explored. So that brought me into the Irish-American history. And through history, that led me into a period with the South Street Seaport Museum,
yeah,
where I was director of corporate relations. And my interest at the seaport was over, it started with the Jeannie Johnson, that ship,
yeah,
bringing that ship to America, which eventually did come to America, thank God. And maybe, who knows, may come back again someday. It seems to be doing well in Ireland at this point. But my interest in the Seaport Museum was because of the Irish-American influence on the docks, on the waterside, on the shipbuilding history that is New York. So that was, so through the magazine, which I have an ongoing relationship,
Irish-American,
as you know,
yes,
with the magazine that was the Irish Force newspaper and Irish Central, and I did a lot of work with the great Claire Grimes on the Irish Echo. So my interest was very solidly on the Irish-American experience. And that is what it really is still focused on.
Yeah. I just want to go to to an article that you wrote for Irish Voice newspaper, headed, of course, by Debbie McGoldrick. And it brought to light just the reality of what was rumored. And what was rumored was, you know, that at Quinnipiac University, you know, had the Great Hunger Museum, Ireland's Great Hunger Museum, and there was, you know, a rumor that, in fact, that this landmark would, in fact, be, initially, that it would be seasonal and it would be whatever, and but there was no hint anywhere along the way. As a matter of fact, you know, Quinnipiac University was saying, well, you know, we're looking for partners, we're looking for whatever. But you broke a story, one which I would like to talk about today, that not only was Quinnipiac University, Ireland's Great Hunger Museum, going to close permanently, but that there was no plan at all as to what would happen to, you know, what is the world's greatest collection of art and artifacts pertaining to Ireland's, you know, famine, known as the potato famine of 1847 to 1852. We find it difficult to believe it, but perhaps you tell us the story.
Well,
that not only was it was initially in the Irish Voice newspaper and has been picked up by Irish Times, by Irish Central, and just about everywhere. Tell us the sad and bad news of
Adrian, first of all, my thanks to Debbie McGoldrick, editor of The Irish Voice. You know, Debbie is someone you go to when you know there's a story that needs to be told in the Irish community.
Yes,
and,
indeed.
You know, so Debbie took the story that I had written, and God bless her, she put it on the front page of the Irish Voice newspaper last week. The story has gone viral. The story has been reported in Ireland as well as here in America, social media, other newspapers, other news, other media. And the bottom line is, my story is called Requiem for an Irish Museum. And as you were speaking there, I just thought, Quinnipiac, under the leadership of John Leahy, the former president, John had created the museum to honor the experience of all of the Americans who have some connection to their ancestors. And we're talking millions of people in this country. And John, in his vision as president, a very successful president of Quinnipiac, who, when he retired, left what was a small business college. He left it as a 10,000 student university with an endowment of over $500 million. And part of it was John wasn't just focused on the money, and the, but he was focused on the prestige of that university. And as its president with an Irish-American background, he realized that the story of the Great Hunger was a way to connect the world's situation of the issues that is rampant across the universe. He realized that the Irish story could be a model of education for his students. So I won't go into the whole background. I'll give you a chance to ask me a question. But he realized that, and out of that, he made the decision with the help of one of his great patrons, who was then alive, one of the Lender brothers, whose family made a fortune on Lender's frozen bagels. He realized he created a museum to the Irish Hunger.
Yeah, but then I want to you're inclined to skip over, and I won't let you if we go back to 2010, you presented an exhibition of the art and of Quinnipiac University in the Irish Consulate in New York.
Right.
And in attendance, you had, of course, the John Leahy and Murray Lender and, several others who were, in awe of the existing collection from Quinnipiac University. And it's no exaggeration to say, that without that exhibition and without your role as the first curator of what would become Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University, we won't speculate as to what would have happened. But I distinctly remember, and so do so many others, that in the consulate with this exhibition, coming from, a part of Connecticut that seemed to be out there somewhere, that was the beginning of what would turn out to be, the Ireland's Great Hunger Museum in Quinnipiac.
That was the beginning. And I can tell you that when my first great friend at Quinnipiac was Lynn Bushnell, who was vice president at the time, and is now retired. But Lynn...
Our great friend as well, yeah.
Exactly, friend of all of ours. Great worker and person and friend. But Lynn had told me about there was plans to take what was then a small collection of artifacts from the library at Quinnipiac, where it was housed, and show it in New York at the National Arts Club down in Gramercy Park. And I said, Lynn, we have to show it at the Irish Consulate. They have a beautiful gallery. We can do it. And she said, well, I don't know if I could convince John to go to take it. I said, well, let's set up a meeting. We set up a meeting with Niall Burgess, who was then the Consul General, and who apparently has just accepted a new role as Ambassador of Ireland to France, which is great for Niall. But anyway, so Niall was there, and he met with John and Linda and myself, and he only had to say one thing to convince John Leahy that the collection needed to be exhibited in the consulate. And that one thing was President Mary McAleese will open the exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, John Leahy said, okay, you're on. So the exhibition began in 2010. And my great partner, I did not do this by myself, my great partner on the history was, of course, Professor Christine Keneally. So working with Christine, we put together the story, we used the artifacts that were available to us, and we told the story maybe for the first time ever using artworks to the public. And the response from the public was absolutely wonderful, enough to convince John and Murray Render, his funder, to continue down the road that would lead to a museum. And then so in 2012, with the then Minister of Transport for the Tánaiste, I believe, Leo Varadkar, we opened the museum in Camden, Connecticut in 2010. And for 8 glorious years, while John was still the president, we began stitching together the narrative for the first time ever, using artwork and artists, I should say, performing artists, musicians, painters, sculptors, to start exploring this great, great aspect of Irish American history. And that lasts right up until John was replaced by a new president whose name is Judy Olian. Mm-hmm. And when Judy Olian came in, she wasn't in the door 5 minutes when I think she was determined to what I would just, as I'm sitting here thinking, to snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory. She decided to absolutely abolish all Irish connections that had been so beautifully preserved and cultivated from Quinnipiac with the Irish-American community. She stopped them marching in the parade, which they had been doing for so many years, at very little cost.
Yeah, 30 years.
You know, it doesn't take a lot of money to march in the parade. And the entire university would swoop to their pride. But then she threw down the gauntlet. She said she would give the museum 2 years to be self-funding. Within that 2 years, the pandemic hit, so they never got a chance. And in the last couple of weeks, the museum has been closed because of COVID, but in the last few weeks, she announced to her public relations department that the museum was closed.
Yeah.
And we are horrified that this great story ends up as a sham.
Mm. Now, you would have to understand, though, that on, you know, the president's residence, which was fine for John Leahy for 30 years, that needed a bit of jickying up, so to speak. And so with her great, you know, attempt at austerity, with a budget of roughly $300,000 a year to run the, you know, the great Irish Memorial Museum, that you know, she needed a swimming pool or, you know, somewhere, because the shower.
Well, she spent $1 million on that.
Hmm.
She spent $1 million on the residence with the swimming pool.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, without going into that part of the story,
right,
let's just focus on the museum.
Right.
The museum has a very modest, $300,000 budget is very modest in the world of museums and what have you. It's practically one page of the New York Times for an ad.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is that museum has been attracting Irish-American families, which, you know, Quinnipiac, people say, oh, it's not nearby. Mm. Well, it shouldn't be nearby. The Smithsonian is not nearby. It is where it is. And where it is, it's midpoint almost between two of America's great Irish-American cities, New York and Boston. So it's in this area where there are many children of Irish-Americans, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, who, you know, have been welcomed to share their history, which is not just Irish history. This is human history.
Mm-hmm.
This is the history of what's going on in our planet today. This is the history of refugees succeeding. This is the history of food shortage being overcome, as it is rampant in so many parts of the world. This is a history that the first objective of any educator is to be part of this story. Here you are in a country that's pulling down monuments, not just in America, but also in the UK and elsewhere, pulling down monuments to history that is bad, to history that is rotten, to history that's all about slaveholding. And here you have a history that is about how to come out of these inhumane treatments to really become solid citizens of the United States. And this person who had the audacity to stop educating us all with this wonderful story that people have worked to put together. It's a total outrage.
It's all of that. You know, and I know you want to stay with the story of the museum, which is now closed. And I would like to bring, you know, an aspect of this that we could just let it go and say, you know, what the hell that was, John Leahy's baby to begin with, and, you know, and, you know, Judy Olian, the new president, she was indeed well known to the chairman of the board, you know, Bill Weldon, who, you know, he actually came, he was chairman of Johnson & Johnson, and, well, reportedly anyway, he retired with $143 million, give or take, and he had, indeed, his own history, and as his, as he retired, he had the distinction of being listed among the worst CEOs by the New York Times, you know, back in 2011. And, you know, I bring these, you know, I inject some of these facts as a way to point out that those who make decisions, such as Bill Weldon and the board there, could hardly, I think it is, you know, it's outrageous that they would even hint that the Irish Great Irish Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University, you know, that they wanted to save money. It's a lot of, you know, excuse the expression, but this is a lot of crap, and it has to stop. But if we sit by and say, and do nothing, we know what happens then. The message might well be that what the hell, the Irish American community really doesn't care that much, or, you know, that had to do with something, and to have no plan whatsoever as to where this world-renowned collection, the one and only collection of its kind, where that's going. This is not only outrageous, but, you know, one would have to wonder whether this is a spiteful undertaking by the new president, and if so, you know, then that's all the more reason why we have to get involved and stop this nonsense and open, I won't say reopen, but open the museum and continue and you know, it's not as if the university indeed is thriving since John Leahy left, because
attendance at the museum is down 20%. This is a fact.
Yeah.
Attendance at the museum in the last couple of years is down 20%. So that is an indicator to me that the university...
Not the university, not the museum.
Excuse me, I'm talking about the university in general, student attendance.
Right.
Is down 20%, which is horrifying. Mm. And, you know, for a university that was always on the rise.
Yeah.
I mean, even John's other great baby at the university was the Quinnipiac Pole.
Right.
Which taught us all how to say Quinnipiac. But, you know, the Quinnipiac Pole is big success. Well, this president, Judy Owen, first thing she also said was she wanted to monetize the pole. So she was talking about, the story is that there was talk about selling the pole to the Washington Post. But fortunately, the board stopped that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, here she comes in gunning for two of the major reasons that Quinnipiac is on the map, the pole and the museum.
Mm.
And, you know, as a result, I believe there's a direct connection between those missteps and the fall in attendance of students. Like, you know, this is also, there's a big population of Catholics who go, this is not a religious university,
yeah.
But there's a large-scale Catholic population going to the school as well because of the different histories of the area. So, I mean, what parent looking at the school would feel that there was not a vendetta against our history, would want to send their kid there? You know, so they have a public relations mess on their hand, which was reported in what one of the biggest PR newspapers recently, that it was a real mess and they should reopen the museum. And why shouldn't they reopen the museum? But if they don't reopen the museum, the focus should be on that collection. How dare they think that they can break up that collection, which has been rumored? That collection is not just bits and pieces of artifacts. It's a story. It's a story that has been pulled together right from the great work of Christine Keneally, from a curator at the Museum, Neil Sullivan. You know, it's been pulled together by lots of intellectual thought and scholarship.
Mm.
So my feeling is, and I'm already getting phone calls. I got a phone call earlier this week from the son of one of our great Irish-American patron champions who gave the museum artwork. And the father just passed away 2 weeks ago, the great Brian P. Burns, wonderful right. man of the Burns Library at Boston College. Well, his son called me the other day to say, what will happen to his father's gifts to this museum?
Mm.
I got a call from other people. What happens to these gifts? That is, to me, grounds for legal action at the state level.
Yeah.
And people are looking into that as we speak.
And as I say, the first concern, and I agree with you, is to make sure that the collection remains intact and that there is no follow-through on the rumor that, they would, Quinnipiac would take under the stewardship of Judy Olian, that they would take the saleable pieces and get some, some money and throw into the general kitty. That cannot be. And we ought to, absolutely rise up, as it were, to stop, first of all, to stop the breaking up of the collection, the sale or whatever, and until such time, Tarla McConnell, until such time as another fitting, university or museum decides to take that whole collection, keep not only the collection, but keep the museum open. And somehow, for $300,000 a year, that's not a big nut to crack for a university
right.
like
that. A good fundraising campaign would pay the bill.
Yeah.
But it's kind of disgusting that a university is talking about such little money when it's such a huge... Their budget, their annual budget is, don't hold me on this, but I think it's definitely in the hundreds of millions.
Mm-hmm.
Their annual budget for the university. So this little part of it, which has just such a big effect on the profile of the university and on the future of the education of the students, is amazing. I will point out that one of John Leahy's brilliant ideas when he created this museum was not to house the museum in the campus of the university, but it's on the public road.
Right.
It's on the road that links the town of Hamden to the great city of New Haven, Yale, where there are many universities, mostly all bought by the money from slaveholding, let's be clear about it, than this little university that is just dedicated to the success of refugees in America. And, I just want to add one comment. The Irish government is fantastic. Like, the Irish government in 1996, 97, they decided they were ready to talk about the history of the Great Hunger. And from that day forward, they have been, part of that history and supporting that history in Ireland and abroad. The Irish government could certainly help with what's going on here, but I think it's the responsibility of Irish America. This is an Irish American story. The successful part of this is an Irish American story. This is a story of how our forefathers came here and became Americans, became citizens, became the backbone of this country. And so I feel that champions should be sought in America to just keep the doors open, keep the story going, keep the scholars learning and exploring, keep the artists delving into the history, bringing it forward, shining a light on the issues that just invade our planet this day, from Afghanistan to Africa, right across the world, where there are billions of people going through these issues that the Irish went through 150-odd years ago. So let this be a beacon around the world to what can happen, what can come out of that tragedy.
Tola, again, bringing to life, a story that I think, for many would say, well, that's happened in Connecticut, and maybe the current administration at Quinnipiac University might well feel, that the success of Quinnipiac, its amazing reputation, through John Leahy's tenure, there to have a college, to indeed have a college of arts and sciences, and 8 professional schools, business, communication, education, engineering, health sciences, law, medicine, and nursing, to have all of that, and to grow that college from the small, as you mentioned, back in 87, with less than 2,000 students in enrollment. And to have that, and to bring all of it, and to think that maybe we wouldn't notice, or maybe it's not a big deal to take something which, again was part of the success of Quinnipiac University. To take that and just brush it aside and figure out, okay, sure, that's fine. We find a use for that building somehow when they have 3 massive campuses. It's something that I think you're right. If Irish America, or maybe there's another, Murray Leinster or somebody who...
A good Jewish family. It's yes. A good Jewish family to get this started.
Yes.
The Lenders. God bless them. Just a little incidental story. I had the great pleasure through the Maliki Encyclical Court to meet Thomas Keneally.
Yes.
Thomas Keneally wrote Schindler's List.
Yes.
A brilliant Australian writer. And I told him about the Lenders, and he gave me a copy of his then latest book, which he called 3 Famines, the Irish one being one of them. And in the dedication he put, "We tell each other's stories," and he had me give that to the Lenders.
Wow. Again, Tarla, where do we go from here? How do we not let this, despite the proclamation of President Judy Olean of Quinnipiac University. What do we do?
We create a ruckus. We create a row. We pull in the best voices to keep the conversation at a high level.
Mm.
We're going in next year, 2022, is the 10th anniversary of the founding of that museum. Well, the museum is there enough. It's the 10th anniversary of a story that's been told in a great new way. We must not let that story go away. We must honor that anniversary.
For those who might have missed the article, again, initiated by my guest, Tarla McConnell, and first published in the Irish Voice, and now, again, distributed and of course, gone viral. Can we direct, some people who'd like to know more to say, you're obviously the Irish Voice newspaper, but also to you, And you are a PR man. Nobody has ever accused you of being easily, you know, of an easy temper when you get rattled. And of course, going up in any show on those was, you know, that was part of your training. But we have to do something, and we have to do.
Well, the great writer George Russell said, "It's the row that matters. It's the row that matters."
Yeah.
We need to create a row. I've got a website. It's my name.
Right.
CarloMcConnell.com. Anybody who wants to contact me, better than contacting me. Contact this university. Contact Winnipeg University. Either through their, if they're in Connecticut, through their representation, the state senator, the federal senator, their congressmen and women. These people have all been to the museum. Contact the people in Connecticut and say, stop this.
Yeah.
Stop this. Reopen the museum. Save this collection.
You know, we're going to leave it at that, but, Carla, again, thank you for bringing this to our attention, because most of us were, you know, we're, when the rumors were going around, they say we were confident enough to say that something as stupid as just abolishing and closing, you know, the world-renowned museum in Hamden, Connecticut, Ireland's Great Hunger Museum, that couldn't happen. But it has. And we have to do something now. Not let it drift. I thank you, and I thank you very much for...
Thank you, Adrian, and honor for your great support.
God bless. Okay, thank you. Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.